Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we begin a series of programs on three of the most famous or infamous of ancient Romans, Livia, Agrippina, and Caligula. We begin with Livia, wife of the Emperor Augustus and popularly seen as one of the most wicked of all noble Roman ladies. Talking History's Eileen Dugan will be exploring her story with Anthony Barrett, professor of history at the University of British Columbia. And on October 26, we reset our clocks once again, marking the end of daylight savings time. What better time to explore that history as well, which we will with an historian of time, Clark Blaze. But first, Joyce Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on October 21st, 1867, Plains Indians signed the first in a series of what came to be known as the Medicine Lodge Treaties. With the Civil War over and westward expansion renewed, the call went out to remove Indians from the Great Plains. Previously, the arid plains were regarded as unsuitable for settlement, and the Plains Indians had been left to roam free. But the desire to build communication lines and a transcontinental railroad pushed settlers and Indians into war. In 1867, President Andrew Johnson formed a special peace commission to negotiate the relocation of the Plains Indians. More than 7,000 Southern Plains Indians gathered near Medicine Lodge Creek, Kansas, and negotiations began. The commissioners insisted on moving the Native Americans to reservations, but they resisted. As one chief put it, "I have heard you want to settle us on a reservation near the mountains. I don't want to settle. I love to roam over the prairies. There I feel free and happy, but when I settle down, I grow pale and die." But after 3 weeks of negotiations, the treaties were signed, and the Plains Indians relocated to a reservation in western Oklahoma. Most went peacefully. Those who didn't were either killed or captured and forced to leave.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, for nearly a century, no one knew for sure that a history of the Maryland slave named Adam Francis Plummer really existed. His daughter said it did, but her brother preferred to keep it hidden. So Plummer's journal, 200 pages of composition paper, with entries from his marriage in 1841 to his death in 1905, was stashed away by generations of family members. But now a distant relative named Lucille Betty Tompkins Davis has donated it to the Smithsonian Institution's Anacostia Museum and Center for African American History and Culture. Historians see the diary as unprecedented, a first-hand account of a slave's life while going on, not reminiscences, as it clouds over time, is extremely valuable, says Margaret Law Calcott, a University of Maryland historian. Unfortunately, only 48 pages of the diary remain. And the Civil War burning of a river crossing remains an issue to a congressman who estimates his district should be compensated $170 million for the loss. Representative Joseph Pitts intends to restart a long-running debate on the 1863 torching of the wooden Columbia-Wrightsville Bridge over the Susquehanna River during his term of Congress. The bridge was burned 3 days before the Battle of Gettysburg to slow the Confederate advance. "I think I'll say something to Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld about, you know, why you're rebuilding all of the bridges you destroyed in Iraq. Why don't you rebuild one that you destroyed in Lancaster County?" Pitt said, chuckling, "just for fun." And just for fun, this is Talking History. Wife of the Emperor Augustus and the mother of Tiberius, legend has it that she destroyed everyone that stood in the path of her son's ascent to the throne. But how much of that is true? That's the subject of Eileen Dugan's conversation with historian Anthony Barrett.
In those ancient days before VCRs and DVDs, I remember running back to my dorm room every Sunday night at 8 o'clock to catch the next episode of the BBC series, I, Claudius. It was mesmerizing. Such scheming, such treachery, and such a high body count. And so many great performances, including that of Sean Phillips as that most wicked of all noble Roman ladies, Livia, the wife of the Emperor Augustus and the mother of his successor, Tiberius. But however great the performance, was that the real Livia? To what extent are our modern views of her colored not just by a television series, but by ancient propagandists? With us today to re-examine the life of one of ancient history's most vilified characters is Dr. Anthony A. Barrett, Professor of Classics at the University of British Columbia. Professor Barrett is the author of Livia, First Lady of Imperial Rome. Welcome, Dr. Barrett.
Oh, hello.
What is the perception of Livia in the ancient sources?
Well, in the main ancient source, Tacitus, Livia is presented as a villainess. In fact, Livia is presented just as she is in the TV series and from based on Robert Graves' book, I, Claudius. This comes about because Tacitus was a member of the senatorial class. It was the class that had been put to one side when the imperial system came in. So Tacitus was very hostile to the system of Roman emperors, and even more hostile to the women of the imperial family, to the wives, the sisters, the mothers, who interfered in government that he already regarded as somewhat illegal. So he is naturally very, very hostile towards her. And it's a dangerous hostility because Tacitus is such a wonderful, compelling writer that he is persuasive unless one looks very, very carefully at what he has to say.
In your books, you demand reassessments of notorious figures in Roman history that Tacitus and other authors dealt with, like Livia, Caligula, Agrippina. Why is that necessary, and how is that possible?
Well, it's necessary because there has been a tendency for centuries to take the accounts of people like Tacitus and others like Suetonius and the Greek writer Dio and accept them as more or less the truth. And these accounts have been passed on from generation to generation. Now, modern scholars will say, we have to treat Tacitus with some caution. We have to recognize that he is biased and prejudiced, but they tend not then to take the next step and to reconstruct history, taking account of these deep biases. And I think they address their views very well to the scholarly community because we're fully prepared for what we're going to read in the ancient sources. But I think that for the general public, the impressions have been shaped largely by things like I, Claudius. I, Claudius, in turn, is based on the ancient texts. We can't fault Robert Graves. He was a classical scholar, and he followed the ancient texts, but he followed the ancient texts uncritically. And they have now been transmitted to the public at large, and I think create a very false, if engaging, picture of the ancient world. I have to say, I have to be quite honest here, I actually encourage my students to watch I, Claudius to get a good, vivid impression of the early imperial world and to sort out who all the various characters are.
So who was Livia, and how much do we know of her life before she married Octavius?
We know very little of her before her marriage to Octavian, who, of course, becomes Augustus, the first emperor. She, of course, was born at a time when Rome was still a republic, when it was governed by, in a formal sense, a representative democracy, but in practice was controlled by a small number of very powerful families. She belonged to one of these powerful families, the Claudians. She married a Claudian, a man who was very ambitious but largely incompetent. And in the civil wars that took place in the last century of the Republic, her husband seemed to back the wrong side at every turn. And so she led, in her early years, it seems, a rather shiftless existence, traveling from country to country in exile. And we don't, unfortunately, know the details of this life, except that at one stage they tried to escape from Sparta and in a forest fire, and most of her hair was burned off. So that's the kind of anecdote that has survived about this her earlier life.
How did she come to meet and then marry Octavian?
Well, we don't know of the exact circumstances of her first meeting. Octavian came to an alliance with his archenemy Mark Antony, and Livia's husband had been a supporter of Mark Antony. As a result of the truce, there was an amnesty, and so Livia and her husband were permitted to return to Rome. And it seems that very soon after their return, she met Augustus, she met Octavian as he was then, and they fell in love. And I'm prepared to believe the ancient sources on this, that it was a sort of instant love match with certain political advantages on both sides.
Would you consider this to have been a good match, apart from affection?
Well, it was certainly a good match in the traditional way that we look upon a marriage, because they stayed devoted to one another, as far as we could tell, until Augustus's death. It was a good match politically, because Augustus, or Octavian as he was then, was a rising star, and Livia, I think, recognized this, probably having been disappointed by her first husband. She recognized a winner. She was, as I've mentioned, from the powerful Claudian family, so she brought strong aristocratic credentials with her, which were very, very useful to Octavian. So both politically and personally, I think it was almost a perfect match.
In the course of your discussion about Livia's life with Augustus, you note that she was very careful to observe a line of demarcation between the power within the home and playing an overt role in politics. How did she do that, and why was that necessary?
Yeah, that's a good question. It was Livia's great achievement, I think, to strike this balance. The Romans were relatively enlightened when it came to the status of women. Women could own property in a way that they are still unable to in many parts of the world, and couldn't do so in the Western world until well into the 20th century. So they had a number of rights that were quite impressive. But on the other hand, women were not allowed to hold public office. This was a firm, fixed rule. Their sphere was the domus, was the household. When the imperial system came into being, this presented a problem, because the emperor's domus, the emperor's home, became the sort of first family of the Roman world, and in many ways it became identified with the state. The family had to embody all the qualities of the Roman state. So this meant that Livia did not hold a public position. Technically, she was simply the wife of Augustus. But at the same time, she did represent a family that was regarded by Romans as, in some ways, the ideal embodiment of the Roman family. And she succeeded in doing this by, I think, largely by an understanding what we now call public relations. She realized that if she wanted to influence affairs, that she had to do this very, very much behind the scenes. She couldn't thrust herself forward and assert herself as a public figure. She had to do it indirectly, through influence on her husband, through indirect friendships. She was very, very generous all classes of Romans, and in the Roman system, this kind of activity was reciprocal. She would be generous to Romans, and in return they would give her their support. Even in her appearance, she was very, very skillful. We know from ancient comments and from statues and the like that she obviously dressed very well, but she was, reminds me of Jackie Kennedy. She wore elegant clothes, but nothing ostentatious or showy. She didn't wear lots and lots of jewelry, which would have offended conservative Romans. And her great-grandson, Caligula, the emperor, described her in a phrase, Ulixe Stolata, Ulysses in a matron's garb. Ulysses, the clever, cunning Greek hero, but she wore the matron's garb, which was the great symbol of propriety and respectability. She also, I should mention the final point on this, she was very, very careful to project an image of moral uprightness. And this she would have had to work on, because all of the other imperial women have stories attached to them about their sexual misbehavior. There's not a single hint anywhere of Livia committing any kind of sexual impropriety. And I think this was something she realized was very, very important to the Romans. She had to project herself as a very highly moral person.
What was Livia's relationship with her son Tiberius? Did she, as the ancients would have us believe, do all that she could to guarantee that he would be Augustus's successor? Did he really, you know, did she really kill all those people?
Well, the ancient sources have her as with a kind of monomania that she's determined, above all else, to make sure that her son would succeed. And to bring that about, she had to murder, she had to poison, usually, all of those who stood in his way. Well, first of all, on the murders, when we look at these in detail, the arguments just don't hold up. One of them, for instance, Gaius Caesar, whom Augustus had adopted, was killed on the eastern frontier when he foolishly went too close to the enemy camp and was struck by an arrow and then died of fever sometime afterwards. So the ancient sources still attribute that kind of death to Livia, but it's pretty well fantastic. And I think the truth is that Augustus had decided that Livia's son, Tiberius, would succeed him as emperor. And Augustus knew his own mind. He listened to Livia's advice, but he knew his own mind. He was politically very, very shrewd, and he had decided on Tiberius. It didn't really need Livia maneuvering, manipulating on the sidelines to bring this about. Tiberius was a great general. He was enormously popular. He was an able administrator. So I think that was decided anyhow. Relationship with her son, we don't know much about that before Tiberius became emperor. Tiberius, in fact, spent most of his time outside of Rome as a general on various frontiers, and a very successful one. So we don't know of any friction between him and his mother before he became emperor, and I don't think there's any reason to think that there would have been, except that Tiberius, unlike Augustus, had a very strong sense of the proper place for a woman. Augustus accepted that Livia could not, of course, hold public office, but he nevertheless saw Livia as a very valuable advisor, source of wisdom and counsel. Tiberius not only felt that a woman shouldn't be in office, but he felt also that she should, in a sense, know her place, that she should remain silent, that she shouldn't offer advice, she shouldn't interfere. So I think that perhaps even before he succeeded Augustus, Tiberius might have been a little wary of his mother.
What do you think was Livia's positive legacy? I mean, was she involved in any construction projects or anything good about Rome?
Livia left a very positive legacy of herself in the sense that she was highly regarded as the kind of ideal of Roman womanhood for generations afterwards, she unfortunately didn't really leave a lasting political legacy, because the other imperial women didn't use her as the model that she provided for them, and to their cost. In terms of building projects and so on, yeah, she was involved in encouraging a certain number of, building certain temples and the like, and she established some charitable foundations, which I suppose you could describe as a legacy. But I say Livia's legacy mainly came in this kind of image of the ideal imperial wife that was there for other women to aspire to. But if anything, it might have had a rather sort of negative impact, because I think that the Romans afterwards tended to measure the later wives against the standard of Livia and found the later women lacking.
You've already mentioned Jackie Kennedy in terms of being a first lady. Can we see any similarities between the life of Livia and other modern first ladies like Nancy Reagan or Hillary Clinton?
People will often say that they see an analogy with Hillary Clinton. And I don't really see that, because I think that while Hillary Clinton was the first lady, she played a very public role in political affairs, in her role in attempting to reorganize the health scheme. So I would say there wasn't a parallel there, but I think that Nancy Reagan is a wonderful parallel. And we, of course, should never push historical analogies too far, but if I look at the Reagans, I think here is a couple. In each case, I believe it's true of the Reagans, it was a second marriage, that they'd both been divorced, as was the case with Augustus and Livia. They both, as far as we know, certainly in the public image, both couples were devoted to one another. They were noted for that. Nancy Reagan, someone who was very elegant in the way that she dressed, believed in astrology, as we discovered, as Livia did. Also, and I think this is the most important parallel, I think Nancy Reagan was very influential over her husband, but she did it in the background. And the public life that she played, again, analogous to Livia, I think she played a public life that was, one would say, appropriate to the First Lady. As I recall, she was involved in encouraging young people not to use drugs. This is something I think that the Americans would accept in an American First Lady, while many Americans were not willing to accept Hillary Clinton being involved in matters of health policy and the like. The same thing was true in Rome, that Livia could sponsor temples, she could sponsor charitable activities, because the Romans thought that was appropriate of the emperor's wife. But like Nancy Reagan, she didn't intervene publicly and directly in political matters.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Barrett.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Dr. Anthony Barrett, professor of classics at the University of British Columbia and author of Livia, First Lady of Imperial Rome.
Welcome back. For our site of the week, we've chosen a new museum housing some of the oldest artifacts in the world and located not far from a new old library. Here to explain all of this is Talking History's Fiona Beatty.
Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak has inaugurated a new antiquities museum displaying over 1,800 items from his country's 5,000-year history in the Mediterranean port city of Alexandria, Egypt. The Alexandria National Museum, located in a restored mansion, houses artifacts from the country's Pharaonic, Roman, Coptic, and Islamic eras. Mummies are shown in special underground chambers. Last year, Alexandria celebrated the opening of the $230 million Bibliotheca Alexandria, a modern version of the ancient library of the same name, founded around 295 BCE.
And finally, we turn to our commentary of the week. In the spring, we spring ahead. 1 hour to be exact. In the fall, we fall back by the same amount of time. But just what is this all about? Why do we play around with time? Interesting questions to which Clark Blaise offers us some answers. Blaise teaches at Southampton College of Long Island University. He's also the author of Time Lord, Sir Sandford Fleming, and the Creation of Standard Time.
Playing around with time would not have pleased Sandford Fleming, the Canadian engineer who devised the worldwide system of time zones. He would have felt it a violation of an important principle. For Fleming, there was only one time, a function of the Earth's rotation and its tilt. Adjusting it, even for popular reasons, is an invitation for the return of primitive conventions that for thousands of years had kept every village locked in its own little sundial bubble of a solar noon. Every town kept its own time. In keeping with his Presbyterian practicality, Fleming labeled his time zones with impersonal letters, just so we wouldn't get attached to them and start calling them Eastern, Pacific, and Mountain. His zones stretched from R to W. Standard time is one of man's greatest achievements and certainly his most invisible. It is an invention of the Victorian age, less than 120 years old, fought over in rancor and settled only in a great scientific and diplomatic conference held in Washington, D.C. in October 1884. It first had to be settled when and where standard time would begin. The Earth's daily rotation makes any place as accurate as any other. Everyone has a 24-hour day. Greenwich was chosen as the starting line for its commercial advantage. 90% of the world's shipping already used Greenwich charts. The French called that British advantage the Greenwich clientele, thus transforming a leafy London suburb into a temporal Place Pigalle. France also never agreed to the Greenwich time convention. French official time was based on the Paris meridian, retarded, however, by 9 minutes and 22 seconds, thus putting it in line with the rest of the world, or the rest of the world in line with Paris. And when does the day begin? At sundown for Jews and Muslims, sunrise for Hindus and Buddhists, but the tilt of the earth guarantees that sunrise and sunset, except on the equator, will not occur at the same time in any two successive days. In other words, it's a terrible way to run a railroad. Therefore, the world's civil day begins at midnight, so as not to be influenced by local conditions, except at the poles. And where does one day end and a new one begin? In the middle of the Pacific, along the far side of the Greenwich Meridian. Our fling with daylight savings is over, but when you turn your clock back, think of Fleming and what life was like before standard time, when there were 18 different times between Washington, D.C. and Boston, and Newark was officially 1 minute behind New York City. Standard time eliminated the unimaginable complexities of solar time, and as such, was one of the great modernizing events in all of human history.
You've been listening to Clark Blaise, author of Time Lord, Sir Sandford Fleming, and the Creation of Standard Time. And that wraps up another week of Talking History. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beattie, assistant producer. If you'd like to learn more about Talking History and the Organization of American Historians, visit our website at oah.org. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.